Good evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Impulga. This evening, we have a special guest, the author of a book that talks about the conflicts in northern Uganda, Sudan, South Sudan, Rwanda, Congo, and Somalia. And joining us from New York is Helen Epstein. She is a journalist and researcher. She has a book out. The book is called Another Fine Mess, America, Uganda, and the War on Terror. Welcome to Reporters Roundtable, Helen.
Thank you so much, Douglas.
You're welcome. Now, first of all, first tell our listeners, how did you get interested in Uganda in particular and the Great Lakes region of Africa in general?
Well, I was, I used to be a biochemist, and I went to Uganda in 1993 to work on an AIDS vaccine project. And while that project didn't work out, I became very fascinated and attached to the country and many of the people there, and have stayed in touch with many friends since then and watched the country sort of progress historically over the past 25 years. And when I first went there, I think most people were very optimistic about how things would work out there. But what we didn't know is that Uganda was actually becoming, even then, the eye of the storm of a series of conflicts that were actually breaking out in neighboring countries, and which have all, it turns out, at least do seem to be kind of linked up, beginning with the war in Sudan, Rwanda, the civil war that culminated in the genocide, and then the Congo wars which followed, and then finally the Somalia crisis. It turns out Uganda, this sort of seemingly peaceful eye of the storm, has had a hand in all of those conflicts. And I really, the book really seeks to understand those linkages and understand the process by which that happened.
I see. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of the book, first of all, any idea on how you got to the title of Another Fine Mess?
Well, I guess the title is actually, it's the same title as a film by a comedy duo called Laurel and Hardy, who in the 1930s, they were slapstick comedians, and whenever, you know, if there was ever a rug, Laurel would slip on it. If there was ever a window shade or something, Hardy would yank it down and it would fall on the floor and so on. They were constantly getting into trouble and being chased by the police and whatever. And I really, what the book covers is really America's involvement in this region and its diplomatic and at times military assistance to some of the, really to Uganda, and how that has fostered, intentionally or not, some of the conflicts in the region. And really it's a kind of, in some ways, it's a kind of tacit comparison to America's meddling in the Middle East that has also worsened existing tensions, of course, in that region. Our invasion of Iraq being the biggest example of that. But I think that there's a parallel with what's been going on in Central Africa since the end of the Cold War.
I see. Your book traces Uganda's hand in the conflicts, as you see, in the past three decades, in the conflicts in Sudan, South Sudan, Rwanda, Congo, Somalia. And again, on international scene, most people seem to think Uganda is a stabilizing force. Uganda is doing great. How has Uganda, in your opinion, managed to play the double wears, so to speak?
To play what?
To appear international stage as being the stabilizing force, while on the other hand, cultivating these conflicts in these countries.
Well, I don't know, and this is the puzzling thing. This is really the sort of central question of the book: is why is it that nobody really has told this story before, and why don't we know this? but I think my there's a famous in African folklore, there's a famous character, actually Br'er Rabbit, who's famous around the world, is originally an African character, and children all across the continent learn the story of this kind of rather, you know, compared to the other bigger, stronger animals like the lions and the elephants and the hyenas. Br'er Rabbit is a small, fragile creature, but still managed to outsmart his stronger adversaries by tricking them and by being clever and outsmarting them and jumping from one briar patch into another and sort of leading the stronger animals astray. And that seems to be somehow what Uganda's leader, Yoweri Museveni, has been able to do by, in a sense, somehow promising the American, successive American administrations that he knows how to handle the crises in the region, that American troops aren't necessary, for example, to try to sort out some of these crises. Of course, since the Somalia debacle and even before, the United States has been very reluctant to get its own soldiers involved in African crises because they are so complicated and often so brutal. And so Museveni has kind of taken on the mantle of being our proxy warrior, really, in the region, and reassured presumably the members of the Defense Department and so on, who continue to supply him with massive amounts of weaponry and foreign aid of other sorts and diplomatic support and so on, so that he's kind of been untouchable.
I see. Talking of the current president, Yoweri Museveni, this is the guy who came in, this is the president who came in power in 1986, and is a very close military ally of the U.S., as you say. Lots of money, according to your book, has been poured into Uganda. It must be very beneficial to Museveni himself, and maybe not so to the United States. Or is it, in your opinion, a mutual benefit to them?
Well, I think it has. It's certainly a great benefit to Museveni, who has enriched himself massively, and also this has kind of enabled him to suppress democratic opposition inside his country, maintain his grip on power, rig elections, intimidate people, bribe the electorate, and so on, subvert the Constitution. The benefits for the United States, I don't think that the Americans have quite woken up yet to how much damage this relationship has done to them. I don't think the Americans know that yet. I think that the American government, at least, still sees Museveni as a faithful partner, which is unfortunate. And this has been a relationship that's gone on since really the Reagan administration.
I see.
But the costs are enormous. I mean, the costs in terms of the refugee crises, the wars in which Museveni has been involved are responsible for, have basically been the cause of virtually all the refugees on the continent now, and many of whom will end up at least on Europe's doorstep, if not on our own, quite soon.
Talking of the conflicts in the region, of course, we remember the Rwanda genocide, the Congo Wars, the Sudan Civil War, Joseph Kony's massacres in northern Uganda. How, in your opinion, has he been able to play all this and get off scot-free?
Well, I think in each case, he has a certain sort of general modus operandi, but he also, each case is different. So let's, for example, in each case, he works through other groups. So, for example, if we look at what happened in Rwanda, most people think of the Rwanda genocide, which erupted in 1994, as being a kind of spontaneous uprising of the Hutu majority of the population against the Tutsi population, which was a minority in that area. And there had been tensions between Tutsis and Hutus in the country for time immemorial, for a very, very long time. But then they suddenly erupted in this brutal bloodshed that killed almost 1 million people in 1994. And but somehow what gets left out of that narrative is what led up to that bloodshed, and particularly what happened after Museveni took power in 1986, which was 8 years before the genocide. When he came to power, his victory really relied very heavily on Tutsi exiles who were living in Uganda at the time and had long wanted to return to their country but had not been allowed to by the government of Rwanda. And they helped Museveni take over in Uganda. They were extremely skilled and rather brutal military officers. They were extremely skillful at their job. And they their next move, as soon as Uganda was essentially settled in 1987, they formed a new group whose aim was really kind of widely known to be to take over their own country by force and to invade. And they did so in 1990. And for some reason, around the same time, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait at right around the same time. And he was met with kind of international opprobrium, threats of war, which eventually occurred, sanctions and so on. Whereas the Tutsi invaders from Uganda, who crossed the border in 1990, right around the same time, nobody seemed to notice that. It was barely reported in international media, and the international community did not condemn it. There were no sanctions against Museveni, who was clearly supporting them, these rebels, and was feeding them with weapons throughout this period. And the Americans knew it. And this just continued for 3.5 years during this kind of civil war period that led up to the genocide. And then finally, everything fell apart in April 1994 when the Hutu majority the president was killed in a mysterious plane crash. And the Hutu majority then just rose up and began killing every Tutsi they could find because they didn't know what was going on. And they were absolutely terrified that these invaders were going to take over their country and return them basically to a time in history when they felt like slaves in their own country. And yet Museveni's role in that whole process, his aid to the invaders, the Tutsi invaders, and the fear that struck in the Hutu majority, who of course reacted reprehensibly, is very little known outside of scholarly circles, and I felt that more people really need to know about it. So that's just one example of how Museveni has kind of escaped any censure. Really, I mean, it's a kind of conspiracy of silence, I think, on the part of the international community, and it's very disturbing.
I see. Now, for those just joining us, you're listening to Reporters Roundtable, and we are coming to you live from VOA Studios here in Washington. Tonight, we have a special guest who is Helen Epstein. She's a journalist and a researcher, and she has a new book, In Another Fine Mess, America, Uganda, and the War on Terror. Now, Helen, you chronicle about the Rwanda genocide and how it happened. Another bigger even catastrophe was the DR Congo. Even now, recently, Ugandan forces have been shelling some parts of DR Congo. Can you briefly tell us what led to that and how you see it playing out even right now?
That's another interesting story. As soon as the Rwanda Patriotic Front had taken over and established itself as the new leadership of Rwanda, Rwanda and Uganda immediately began recruiting members of exiled Congolese rebel groups, or Zairean rebel groups, as they were then known, that had been more or less moribund. They'd long been trying to trouble or even overthrow the leader of Congo at that time, whose name was Mobutu Sese Seko, and had been established as the dictator of that country in the 1960s and had ruled it ever since. But by 1994, there were these kind of moribund rebel groups kind of scattered around East Africa. And Museveni, along with Kagame, assembled them and organized them and assisted them in their attempt to topple Mobutu and take over. And that mobilization essentially took 2 years. And in 1996, this assembly of Congolese, Uganda, and Rwanda-backed rebel groups, which was known as the AFDL, invaded Congo with Rwandan troops and also Ugandan troops. And they marched across the country, and they toppled Mobutu and took power in 1997. And there is scholarly research. There's a pretty good scholarly consensus at this point that the Americans were involved in providing assistance to that mobilization and to that invasion. There's an interesting book called "When Comrades: Why Comrades Go to War" by Philip Ressler and Harry Verhoeven, two scholars at
I see.
Who studied this in detail, and they show that the Americans actually provided some non-lethal training, equipment, and so on for this invasion. And what the what America's purposes were are not quite known.
I see. As you mentioned earlier on, the Museveni government in Kampala has received lots of military aid from the states. And gotten a lot of development aid. The World Bank claims Uganda is an economic development success story, but from the facts on the ground, that doesn't sound to be true.
No. This is the thing, is that for a very long time, Uganda has been praised as a great economic success story. But the truth of the matter, in particular by the World Bank, which even wrote a whole book about it called Uganda Recovery that came out in 2000, and I think encouraged a lot of investment into the country, and a lot of companies actually went in. But unfortunately, they're all pulling out now because they very quickly realized there's virtually no middle class in Uganda. It's 80% of the population, I think, is still impoverished rural peasants who live on the land and couldn't survive otherwise. And so cell phone companies have closed and closed up shop, and banks are closing and pulling out, and shopping centers are closing. Even British Airways, the flagship of the old colonial master, doesn't fly there anymore. So these are all indicators that the Ugandan economy is nowhere near as robust and healthy as it's said to be. And the experience of the local people's public services are virtually non-existent. I mean, there are schools and clinics, but they're seldom populated by doctors and teachers, because the doctors and teachers are paid about the same amount of money as they were paid when I first went there 25 years ago.
I see.
So a doctor may earn $350 a month, which even in Uganda, no one can survive on that. And teachers earn even less. So we have some of the highest child mortality rates in the world there, and maternal mortality rates very, very high as well, and literacy rates have fallen, so I gather. So, and the highest, lowest school completion rate, I think, almost in the world.
Mm-hmm. The book describes Uganda as a militarized dictatorship with a democratic face. What does that mean?
A militarized dictatorship with a democratic base. Well, there are elections. There's a there's a sort of lively parliament where debates take place. There are plenty of newspapers, which some of which have critical discussions of government policies and so on, and are even critical of Museveni himself. But behind the scenes, there's a kind of powerful paramilitary structure that goes right down to the village level. And it's entirely appointed by the president. And it goes right down, so you'll have these sort of village committees, armed village committees, resident district commissioners, and so on. And they have their own weapons. They virtually overrule what elected officials say. They can close NGOs and newspapers. They can intimidate people. They can arrest people and so on. And so really people are being watched all the time. And in a way, the strategy is kind of, it's not like North Korea where nobody dares speak or even think negative thoughts about the regime, but it's more like Mao's Let a Hundred Flowers Bloom, where Mao kind of encouraged people to talk openly about their opinions of the regime, the communist regime in the 1950s, and then he kind of through that knew what everybody was thinking, so he could target those who were speaking, were touching areas that he didn't want them to go into. So there are certain kind of no-go areas which journalists must stay away from.
I see. Recently, President Museveni has just signed into law a clause amending the Constitution to remove term limits and extend his term to 7 years alongside that of members of parliament and other politicians. This, in spite, some people have said, is America's support for such a strong man rule in Africa. Is that Museveni's Trump card, so to speak?
What do you mean, the American support?
Yes, because he can do as he wishes, can amend the Constitution any day of the week, and there's no condemnation from anywhere.
Yeah, and there's no consequences for it. Well, I think a lot of people were very puzzled. I mean, everyone is coming out of the woodwork right now to because there's an uprising in Iran, and there's been massive publicity about that, and U.S. administration is voiced support for this and so on. And even in neighboring Congo, the Americans have also been very, and the Europeans have always also been very sort of vociferous about that. Meanwhile, over in Uganda, Museveni pushed through a constitutional amendment that allows him to stay in power pretty much until the 2030s. And The international community has been utterly silent about it. And the tragic thing about it is that it was that essentially 80% of Ugandans, according to two independent surveys, did not want this constitutional amendment to pass. So it's massively unpopular because Museveni is massively unpopular. And there was a very inspiring campaign to prevent this amendment from passing. So people went on marches, they protested peacefully, they would wear red headbands, which were kind of symbol of opposition to this, the passing of this age bill. Members of parliament were absolutely heroic in trying to filibuster the bill by singing the national anthem over and over again on the floor of the House. And what Museveni eventually did to get the amendment to pass, which required a vote of parliament, was to send his essentially private military force in plain clothes onto the floor of parliament to arrest opposition MPs and drag them out physically. Mm. And several of them were injured in the process. One of them claims to have been dragged down to the basement of parliament and tortured. She came out of parliament that day. Barely able to walk. She was crippled, and she subsequently had to have an operation to repair three vertebrae in her spine in India. Mm-hmm. And she appears to be okay, but that was an appalling assault on democracy, which went almost without comment. It was not reported by the BBC. It was not reported by vast majority of newspapers and media outlets. The embassies within Uganda made no statement about it. And it really, really was a very revealing moment about,
yes, indeed,
concerning the Sevenese community.
Yes. And lastly, Helen, now that Museveni has gotten rid of that clause that would have stopped him from running again after age of 75, what do you think it will take for a political, especially a peaceful political transition in Uganda, briefly?
I think these things are hard to affect. At this point, Museveni is so incredibly powerful and has really taken over every arm of government and every arm of the state, really, and militarized it, that it will be hard to dislodge him. But one thing that would greatly help is if the international community would recognize the way he's played us and the way he's misused our generosity and the way he has oppressed not only his own people but so many other people in the whole region, and the way that he's been really responsible indirectly or directly for so much of the mayhem and death that's occurred there since the end of the Cold War.
I see.
So I think at first we need to start with an awakening to this and then figure out what to do. I mean, eventually, look what happened to Mugabe. I mean, eventually the forces around him, once he was isolated internationally, became stronger and were able to shift him out of power. We'll see what happens next.
And meanwhile, the aid flows will keep flowing in, the money will keep pouring into his government.
We hope that that would stop one day. We wait.
I see. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of Reporters Roundtable. Thanks very much, Helen, for being on the show.
Many thanks, Douglas.
You're welcome. Helen Epstein, author of Another Fine Mess, America, Uganda, and the War on Terror. She was a journalist and a researcher. Our producer was Jackson Mufunganyi. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. A reminder that you can hear our roundtable on the internet, or you just have to go to our main website at www.voanews.com, click on programs and scroll down to Reporters Roundtable. You can also drop us a line. Our email is reporters@voanews.com. Thanks very much for tuning in, and until next week, I'm your host Douglas Simpuga in Washington.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
You are listening to Upfront, the Voice of America.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today, because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA News Feed. VOA News.
This is VOA News. I'm Liz Pelka. The